Hello, this is Kevin Rowland from Dexys. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 406 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we are blessed to have Kevin Rowland of Dexys, formerly Dexys Midnight Runners, who has a new LP, The Feminine Divine, out July 28th. Tracks are on streaming services now, and of course you can get vinyl bundles, autograph records, picture discs, etc. at dexysofficial.com. Also of note is the new Tu Raye remix, Tu Raye, as it should have sounded, again, on vinyl streaming, and it really sounds gorgeous. Now today, Kevin and I talk all about his journey, the early days, the records, the Killjoys, Bernie Rhodes and the Dance Stance single, the various mixes and test pressing shenanigans of Gino, the juggernaut of Come On Eileen, and much, much more. Plus, there's an extended version of this interview only available to patrons of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. Helping support the show, $5-$10 a month, whatever you can afford. You get lots of extras up there. You help keep this podcast going, and you get more interviews, more Kevin, more music factoids, and miscellaneous vinyl nerdery. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and thanks in advance for your support. And with that, let's get into our conversation with Kevin Rowland of Dexys. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us here. This podcast is The Vinyl Guide, and we talk a lot about records. I understand you're not much of a record collector, but you've been on plenty of them, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I like them, but I haven't got any. I haven't got any vinyl.
Zero. You have no vinyl tucked away anywhere.
No, I've just been given a couple of hours of the new album. That's it.
Oh,
but
okay.
I'll pass them on to friends, family, you know.
Okay. You don't have a player or anything?
No, I don't. I don't CD, no CD player either.
Oh, okay. But do you have, how do you listen to music, or do you listen to music?
I do, but probably not enough. I listen on Spotify, YouTube, all that sort of stuff, you know.
Well, fair enough. Now, were you raised with records? Did you have a lot of records in the house as a kid?
Not loads. No, a few.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't have a record player till I was about 9, something like that. Eight, maybe.
Oh, eight. Okay.
But no, there wasn't a big emphasis on records. They were expensive in those days, you know.
Yeah. So, do you recall your first record when you did get the player? What you went out and bought?
Yeah, it was a single. I went out to buy Can't Help Falling in Love with You by Elvis. But the shop had run out, so I ended up buying Carl Denver's Wimaway.
Okay.
Yeah.
The money was burning a hole in your pocket. You had to bring something home.
Exactly. Rather than what I really wanted, I got something I didn't really want or thought was okay, but not really what I wanted, you know.
Now, were you kind of hooked on records as a kid? Were you saving up all your pocket money to buy records?
No, I think I was sort of incapable of saving. I'll just spend it on sweets, but birthdays and stuff like that, I'd get records, you know. I don't think we had loads of pocket money really. So records were a big deal. They were a little bit out of the price range, you know. So like they were like, 6 and 8, which would be the equivalent of like, here now, 40 pence, 40 cents or whatever. And the pocket money would have been about 5 cents, you know? So, you know, it would be in a lot of saving.
Right.
To get a record,
so. Okay, so birthdays or holidays or something, maybe someone would give you. They used to have the record tokens in the UK, as I understand. Yeah. That was one way to get records. Okay.
That was one way to get records. But I did quite a lot on the cheap. What I would do was go into record shops, and in those days they had listening booths, you know? And I would just ask them to put on a certain record and just go and listen to it, you know. You didn't have to buy it, you know.
Do you remember any music or records that kind of flicked a switch on you that made you want to get closer or even be involved in making music?
Probably Elvis. probably Elvis and the same track, Can't Help Falling in Love. You know, I think I just always loved music from the very off. And, you know, any chance I got, I was singing. You know, like if the teacher said, who wants to sing a song, I'd volunteer.
And around the time of Beatles or anything like that, did that excite you? Did that get you into it, or were you?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. We loved the Beatles. Yeah, they were a phenomenon, weren't they? Just so many great songs. Yeah, that got me into it more, you know. But I also kind of liked other groups as well. You know, I was a big Dave Clark Five fan. I liked the beat. I liked the rhythm. And a few years later, a couple of years later, started hearing Tamela on the radio, on the pirate stations initially.
Okay.
More about radio for us than records, really. Yeah, in our family. But yeah, the pirate stations were playing Tamela. That was great.
What was it? Do you recall any moments or songs or records that made you want to start playing music?
No, it wasn't really. It was just a given for me. I always wanted to do music from when I can remember. Like so-and-so said in Goodfellas, he said, as long as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. Same with me with music. Always wanted to do music since I could remember. There was nothing going to put me off it. And there was no one record that did that for me. I just loved music, you know. And there was TV programs, you know, Thank Your Lucky Stars. And then it was later Ready, Steady, Go. And then it was Top of the Pops. You know, I'd live for those programs to watch what was on. Everybody watched those programs in those days. It was great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then as I got into my teens, I guess I sort of forgot about the idea. I just thought, well, it's not really practical to be a singer. And I sort of given up on it, really. I thought I'd just try and find another career. And then I was very lucky. I got in my brother's band when I was 21. And then I just started to think about writing and singing a bit.
Was it was it like a punk influence band? What kind of band was it?
No. It was a covers band. It was before punk. And it was, this is about 75. And it was kind of country and western, rock and roll, classics. The people wanted to hear in the clubs, you know, in the social clubs, an older crowd, you know.
And up until that point, I mean, getting on stage, it sounds like when you were young, you had no problem getting up singing in front of the school. So getting up on stage, you know, as a 20 something year old with a guitar in your hand, that probably wasn't much of a stretch for you. Yeah.
No, I found it really hard because I've gone through a period where I didn't think I could do music, and I just lost confidence in my singing and all of that. And so I found it really difficult. I was so nervous. Yeah. And when I tried to sing, it didn't sound good. I didn't like the way it sounded. So I didn't sing for a while. And then I thought, okay, let me try some backing vocals. My brother was a singer. I'll try some backing vocals. And that's how that went, you know. And then I eventually thought, well, let me try another one. And eventually, okay, it's not so bad. I'll sing another one and so on like that.
So how did you transition from that band to the Killjoys? How did you get there?
Yeah, well, I just thought after a while I got fed up of playing covers to middle-aged and old people, you know. And I just thought, I'd like to form a proper band now. And I started to form the band. And as we were forming it, punk happened simultaneously. So by the time we finished rehearsing after around 4, 5, 6 months and ready to do gigs, punk was already going. There were punk bands and there were punk gigs and there was a punk audience. And we weren't that dissimilar. It was the same generation. We were like wearing the same clothes. So we just kind of compromised a bit, really, and shortened some of our songs and kicked out the slow ones and basically became a punk band, you know.
Now, I guess you come from this cover band where you had to be very proficient and almost sometimes exacting with someone else's songs. People want to hear it the way that they've become familiar with it. Then when you go to Killjoys playing punk music, where it's a little bit more reckless, people aren't as concerned, especially if you're playing originals. Was that a strange transition for you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. We found it quite hard, really. I didn't really know how to do it, but we got the hang of it after a while.
You didn't know how to be, like, uninhibited with it?
Yeah, and also, I was, like, without guitar. I had no guitar, so
Oh, you were just pure vocals? Okay.
Yeah, so now I was trying to be a front man. So it's quite different. I was playing guitar in my brother's band. So, you know, it's quite a transition, really.
Yeah. So with a guitar, I imagine you had something. It was almost something you could hide behind a little bit. When yeah. it's just you out there, that's got to be even more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely it was.
So there's one record from the Killjoys, Johnny Won't Get to Heaven.
Yeah.
A 7-inch. Is that the first time you were ever on a vinyl record?
Yeah, and the first time we were ever in a studio.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about how that came to be.
A guy just turned up at one of our gigs, probably about our third or fourth gig. And he said, I've got a label. Do you want to record a single? We went, yeah, okay. He said, okay, come down the studio on the 21st or whatever it was. So we turned up. I think we didn't have anywhere to stay the night before, so we slept in the van outside the studio. And went in there the next day. And they record the band separately and then the vocals. So they asked me to do guide vocals along with the band so they could record the band, guitar, bass, and drums. So I did loads of guide vocals, and people were going to me, the vocals sound great. I was like, oh, thank you. And then when it came to do the vocals, I'd done about 30 takes. So my voice was gone. There was nothing left but a bark. And I said to them, have you got any of the previous vocals that you went, no, we've wiped them. I said, oh, okay. So that's why I said, can I come back next week? He went, no, there's no more money. So that's why the vocal sounds so.
Well, that didn't hamper the success of that single that much. I mean, from what I understand, it sold nearly 20,000 copies.
Really? We never got a penny from that. We went around to see the guy and he never gave us anything. He's released it a few times and he's put the other demos that we put down as compilation tracks. And yeah, it's just one of those guys, you know?
Yeah, it's not an unfamiliar story, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
So that was Raw Records. And apparently that label was run out of a music shop, as I understand.
Yeah, it was like a secondhand music shop called Remember Those Oldies.
Mm. So the band, they've never seen a cent. It's just some, no. Yeah, okay. Well, it was a phenomenal success of that record. So on the back of that record, were the Killjoys offered another label, another opportunity to make a record?
No, never really came, because I think that record came out in the height of 77 and the whole punk thing. But I think music was moving so fast that probably the record companies realized that, you know, it wasn't really the future, you know.
Okay.
So by the time 78 came, we were trying to change our direction, the Killjoys. We realized that the punk thing was dying and we better change, you know.
That's really interesting. One thing I've noticed about you and your career, Kevin, is you're not just unafraid to change, but you seek it out, which for an artist, I mean, is phenomenal. But a lot of business people and, you know, the money around the records, that kind of scares them off a bit. I mean, would you agree with that summary?
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think that's true. I think they felt that way. Yeah. They felt that way. You know, they never really said it to me, but I get that impression, you know, because they know the way we work. We're always trying to do something different. But
so you had the idea, you were like, okay, well, I need to change. I need to evolve. And then you formed what became Dexys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any other names other than Dexys Midnight Runners in mind? Anything you went through almost made that list?
Yeah, we had a list and we had Midnight Runners for ages. The words Midnight. We had All Night Runners, then we had Midnight Runners. And we all took a vote. And one guy in the band suggested Wenslow Boy after a book he'd read.
Hmm.
I wasn't really keen on it, and the band voted it in. So I just kind of slightly manipulated the conversation. Can we have another vote? And they said okay. And then we had Midnight Runners. I said, I think it's got to be Midnight Runners, but we need something in front of it. And one of the band, probably not knowing the meaning of the word, said Mandy's Midnight Runners. I think he was talking about the name Mandy. But what it signaled to me was it was a drug called Mandrax that was very popular in the early 70s in England, probably everywhere else. And it was a downer. they, you know, be like, "Have you got any Mandy's?" And it was a downer. I thought, well, we can't have a downer. We want an upper. So I just thought of Dexedrine. They called them Dexys for short, which was a speed that I knew that the mods had used in the 60s. So we said, yeah, let's call it Dexys. So that's how we got Dexys.
Yeah. And when did Bernie Rhodes enter the picture?
Quite soon after we started playing gigs. We did about 6 months rehearsal, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, or whatever it was, 10 to 6, something. And then we started doing gigs, and then Bernard and one or two others started coming along.
He said, yeah, I could do something with this.
Yeah. I think he wasn't massively interested, but he seemed interested, you know. Perhaps just playing cards close to his chest, you know. It's hard to know with Bernard. He's that kind of guy. He wouldn't rave over anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think looking back, I think he was more invested in the Clash still, even though he wasn't working with them at that point. That was his real baby, you know.
Okay.
I think he saw us as some kind of side thing.
So was it Bernie who was able to negotiate the deal? I think you had a 2-single deal at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. With through his label called Oddball, which was going through EMI. So we signed to him, and he signed to EMI.
And the first single, Dance Dance,
yeah,
that was, that's the way to put it, a butchering of the song Burn It Down. Is that fair?
Yeah. The recording was okay. The performance was all right, but the mix was shocking, you know.
Tell me the story of that mix. I hear that was a very... interesting tale.
Well, they just messed it up, you know. After we'd recorded it, I know the recording had gone well, and I was phoning Bernard saying, can we come down, when's the mix, when are we going to mix it, when, you know, when's it coming out, what are we going to do? And he was like, yeah, when it's right for your career, don't worry. And the next thing, our manager, who was close to Bernard and had introduced us to Bernard, local guy Dave Cork in Birmingham, walked into my flat with a test pressing of the single. And I knew even then that the process between finishing the tape and getting a test pressing was a couple of weeks, at least 10 days. But what I got told was, yeah, we had to go in the studio. Bernard had to go in the studio a couple of nights ago, and there was no time to phone you. There was no time to get you in. So we did a mix, and it's great, and the record company love it, EMI love it. That's what I got told, and I put it on, and it just didn't sound at all right. I later found out EMI didn't like it. I later found out that EMI had suggested and actioned a mix by a guy called Dennis Bavell, which equally didn't work. So they'd have this whole drama between Bernard and EMI about the mixing, which we were not party to. We didn't know anything about. We were just being kept out of our own music. And we'd been told that it wasn't going to be like that. We'd been told it was going to be the opposite, that we'd be involved and be creative and allowed to express ourselves properly and, you know, represent the band as we were, not as some, you know, boy band.
And the title Dance Dance, that was also put on by someone other than the band, you know?
Yeah, that was Bernard's idea. And, you know, he made sense to me in a way. He said, look, it's coming up to Christmas. People don't want to think about Burn It Down. They want to, okay. I can't remember if he came up with that or I can't remember.
And I understand there was a similar confusion around Gino. There was a test pressing of Gino that with multiple mixes. Is that right?
There was two mixes of Gino. We were in the studio for Gino. We made sure of it when it was mixed. Mm-hmm. There was one that the producer, Pete Wingfield, did a very good job that he favored. And there was one that I favored. So I phoned up the record company and said, you've got to use the right one. You've got to use the right one. They said, we'll find out when we master it next week. We're going to go to this place where they can master really loud. And we'll use whichever version works best. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know what that means. So I didn't really have any power, so I didn't fight it. And then about 2 weeks later, I got a call from another guy at the label saying, oh, we've had a test pressing back and the track is jumping. So we've got to remaster it, got to recut it for vinyl. Roger's on holiday. That's the A&R guy who I'd spoken to. Mm-hmm. And we can't get hold of Pete, the producer. Would you mind coming down to London to oversee the mastering? Would I mind? No problem at all. So we went down and we make sure we used our version. And when Roger got back from holiday, he heard it on the radio. It was very low in the charts at that point, like 70 or 60 or something. He goes, it sounds, which mix did you use? Sounds bloody awful. But it got to number one anyway.
Ah, did he say much about it then?
No, he didn't say a word. Nobody mentioned it after that. Maybe it would have done better if it, I don't know.
When did you recognize, when did you know that Gino was this going to be this juggernaut single?
I think I, when I heard it, I thought it's easy, good enough to do well. I wasn't thinking of number one, wasn't thinking about chart positions. Mm-hmm. I suppose just as the way it was jumping up the charts, we were like, oh, wow.
And I understand that between Searching for the Young Soul Rebels and Tu Raye, there was a difficulty with the record label. I think, was it Parlophone that didn't pick up the option for the band? They forgot about it?
Yeah, they forgot. So we were free. We went to, and funnily enough, the A&R man from EMI, Parlophone, he'd moved over to Mercury Universal.
Oh.
So, you know, he was a good guy. You know, he believed in us. So we went over there.
For listeners, I guess that meant that you guys were walking away from Parlophone with a number one hit. And essentially, then you were then, by their mistake, a free agent. So you could negotiate another deal with a different record company, which you did for Mercury.
Exactly.
Okay. And in making Tu Raye, you just come off the hit of Gino. Was there pressure to be able to give them another top hit? I mean, what was I mean, how did you feel going into it?
Oh, yeah. A lot of pressure. The last couple of singles had flopped. Yeah. So I did feel a lot of pressure, yeah.
And luckily there was a big hit on that album.
Yep.
When you were recording Come On Eileen, did you recognize the brilliance of it?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VinylGuide10.
10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
When you were recording Come On, Eileen, did you recognize the brilliance of it? Did you recognize that?
Even when we were writing it, we thought, wow, this one could be really good. But you never know, because there's a lot of places it can go wrong. It can go wrong in the production. You know, it might not get played. You just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't overconfident. You know, nobody was going, oh, this song's amazing. It's going to be a great big hit. Nobody was saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Not the manager, not the label, nobody.
It was actually the second single off the album, wasn't it? It wasn't even the lead single.
No, because we'd recorded Celtic Soul Brothers as a trial with the producers, Clive and Alan, before the album. So and released it as a single, but it didn't do that well.
Were you getting any airplay from the previous album or anything in the U.S. at that time?
No.
Okay. So Come On, Eileen was the kind of the first.
Yeah.
Break its air. Okay.
First and only, really.
And you've recently revisited Tu Raye, a remix. Talk to me a little bit about that. You wanted to spend a bit more time and present it in a different form?
Well, you know, we always thought the songs were really good and the performances were good, but Eileen turned out really well and one or two others turned out well. But I always thought the mixes weren't quite right. They could have been better. So when we finished the record, I said to the label, I don't think the mixes are right. Can we spend a bit more money and time and get them right? And he went, no, that's it. The budget's spent. So when it was coming up to the 40th anniversary, I thought it might be an opportunity to see if they'd be up for remixing it. And they were.
And this is still on the Mercury label, or have the tapes and the rights and everything reverted back to you in the years since?
No. It's all on the Mercury label. They own it forever.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I also understand there was a remix, a revisitation, I think, in the late 90s of Don't Stand Me Down, where you had a very similar opportunity to.
No, that was just mastering. That was just the mastering. It wasn't mixing.
Okay.
Yeah. We mastered it wrongly that second time. Second reissue was mastered badly. So we just remastered it.
Yeah. Because the revisited Tu Raye. What is that called? The way it should have been?
Should have sounded.
The way it should have sounded, yeah. There's a 4-LP set with outtakes, a live set, really deluxe booklet. That's very, very collectible.
It really is. They did a really good job for Universal. They were great. They were really good. And Pete Shweer mixed it well, really well. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people can hear that on streaming services now if they want to. You could actually A-B it, the old version and the new version as well.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about. Okay.
Can they be on the streaming services, I suppose? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I was listening to the original mix, and then I said, well, what is this remix? And I listened to that. I was like, wow. All right. This is.
Sounded better?
I think it's geared more toward the modern sonic sensibilities. Yeah.
Wasn't even meant to be modern. It was just that what happened is that it's more pure.
Yeah.
I mean, there was records being made that sounded like that in the 80s. It's just that Alan, who mixed it, put lots of 80s-y sounding effects on it, and they just sounded wrong. I never liked them at the time. They didn't let the music breathe.
On the new version, you could tell, like, oh, there's two separate violins and really kind of single them out, right? It's not this big plate reverb or whatever they had.
Yeah, it's just as it should have sounded. That's all it is. It's just natural. Just let the music speak for itself, really.
Did you have any conflicts about that? Did you have, while doing the mix, did you say, like, oh, you know, this is something that's very associated with it? Did you have decisions that?
No, we didn't have loads of power at that point. You know, last few records had not done well. And also, I wasn't sure. I didn't know what was wrong. Do you know what I mean? Is there something wrong? I can't tell. Do you know what I mean? I was confused a lot of the time.
Talk to me a little bit about the band's appearance on The Young Ones.
Oh, man, I can't remember. It's 40 years ago. Barely remember it. I'm struggling to remember last year.
Well, you've been very busy the last few years. There seemed to be like a little bit of a, you know, in your career, you seem to have taken a bit of a break. big quiet period, and then in recent years, a bunch of new material. So what do you credit that burst of activity to?
I don't know. I just think the stars were aligned or whatever way you want to look at that. You know, it's just like, I don't know, just we tried things before then and they just didn't seem to work. And all of a sudden, everything started working, you know.
Because the new album, The Feminine Divine, it seems like a very personal album. What can you tell me about, I guess, the journey you took making this record?
Yeah, I mean, it is a personal album, and it's about a journey of a guy, you know, who starts off with a very kind of macho approach to life, to other people. And then in the second song, he says, that's not really who I am. And the next couple of songs, he appraises himself and decide where he wants to go. And then he looks at his relationship with women in the fifth track, the title track, Feminine Divine, and he sees where that has been wanting. And then he gets in a relationship in a completely different way to what he would have done before. And then that plays out throughout the album. And the interesting thing is the first song, which is the macho stance, the one that loves you. Me and Jim wrote that song in the early 90s. And that was my stance at that point. And what happened with these songs? We just made a list of all the songs we had and the new ones we'd written. And I thought, oh, hang on a minute. If we put these in an order, this actually tells a story. It's like a text to it, you know. Mm-hmm. Narrative. But that was serendipity. So, yeah.
How closely does that story, that narrative of the record, parallel to you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's 100% autobiographical, but there's definitely a lot of me in there.
Because throughout your career, I mean, very brave decisions, even from your solo period, the cover of My Beauty, 1999, yeah. Very bold decision.
Mm-hmm.
When I listened to this album, I took it as, okay, this is part of Kevin's journey.
It's a lot of it. Yeah. Yeah.
What sort of things, I guess, over the last few decades have you had to unlearn?
Oh, I don't know, really. What things, be very hard to pick, but just all the conditioning that I grew up with, you know, just like, you know, like there was no sex education at my school. There was no sex education at home. Nobody told me anything about that. When you get to 13 or 14, your body's going through all these changes, but there's nobody you can talk to about it. It's a secret. Mm-hmm. So that kind of informed my approach. It was something I wasn't really supposed to be doing, sex, but it's something you wanted to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's a secret. If you do it, you don't tell anybody, you know? So that, you know, that was a bit of a weird way to go into life, adult life. And, you know, so there's no real understanding of women in there. Do you know what I mean? And maybe that's me to some extent. I just didn't fully appreciate women, I don't think. Yeah. I mean, I never learned about them or anything, you know.
Look, I could relate. I wasn't really taught that much either. And what I did learn was mainly through, you know, probably some girly magazines that I stole out of the liquor store, right?
Yeah.
And it took me a while, a bit of an arc for me to kind of see women as not a conquest, but as, you know, a partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Well, again, this journey has been pretty inspiring to watch, and having you go out and be able to be brave enough to talk about these things.
Well, thank you. It's not always easy, but you know, I feel I have to do it, really.
Well, especially the way you were conditioned to kind of hold that in. So
yeah, it's important to let that out. But a problem is, you know, there's a lot of other people out there that are also conditioned to hold that in, and they don't like it when you let it out, you know. So, but I try not to read social media comments, you know, because those guys, you know.
Yeah. Never read the comments. Well, so what? No.
They're stuck in the past. You know what I mean? They're stuck in the past. They want Dexys to be like it was, and they should be used to us changing all the time by now. But, you know, but a lot of people do like it. A lot of them do like it, to be fair. And the ones that don't, you know, good luck to them, you know.
Yeah.
Go on. What were you going to say?
So when people listen to this new album, what would you like them to walk away with?
I don't think like that, really. I think it's really good. That's all I can say. I think it's an interesting album. I think it's musically good. I don't know what people are going to get from it. You know, I know what I've got from it. I know that it's been really important for me to kind of lay it all down. I think it's a really interesting journey. It's maybe a journey that quite a few men have gone through or going through, something similar, if not the same. And I just did it for me, really. You know, I mean, obviously, the tunes are commercial, but I don't have to try and be commercial. I like commercial, you know, good melodies are commercial, and I like good melodies. If we've not got a good melody, we don't want it. You know, we like music that sounds good. So that's what we try to do. Mm-hmm. And then if people like, we've got no control really over what how people perceive it, but I think a lot of people are like it. I don't know. See, I'm still close to it. We only finished it 6 months ago. So I think it look back in a few years' time and we can see what was really going on, you know?
That's frequently been your approach though, yeah? With Dexys is to, you know, each album you made for you, and if people were to come along the journey, that's great, but you're not going to be motivated or really even influenced by what public opinion is.
I think if you try to do that, I think you're in trouble, because what are you going to do? Try and second guess the next trend or try and be like some current artist? What's the point? You can't do it.
Yeah, but that's a very mature way to think about it, especially in an industry where you're surrounded by people that are trying to, you know, shape you in a commercial direction.
Well, we don't really need it. Do you know what I mean? Our stuff is commercial. You know, if you listen to songs like Coming Home, The One That Loves You, I'm Going to Get Free, they're really bang commercial. Whether they get played or anything on the radio very much is another thing. But they're certainly commercial. Wouldn't you think? So,
no, absolutely. I'm saying, but throughout your career, like when you approached Searching for the Young Soul Rebels or To Rye, you know, you were making records for you.
But they were commercial as well, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they turned out to be, but they were very different at the time. They turned out to be commercial, but going into it, I'll just pick on To Rye for a little bit. The music that was there, it was great hooks, great melodies, the visual of the band, some of the instrumentation. It wouldn't have been a surefire bet for a record company at that time. I mean, would you agree?
I don't know. That's for them to figure out. Do you know what I mean? Not me. I'm just doing what we do. You know, we just follow our intuition.
And that's a very brave thing to do, is what I'm saying.
Well, I think that's all you've got. If you're going to try and second guess an audience, you're in trouble. How can you do that?
I get it. Well, Kevin, again, this album, The Feminine Divine, it's a wonderful piece of art. And I'm so glad that you're continuing to record and put out some fantastic material. It's out July 28th. Vinyl, bundles, autograph packages, picture discs are available at dexysofficial.com. You'll also get tour dates if you're in Europe. I think Kevin and crew are coming through, probably through your town and country, possibly the U.S. Are you touring the U.S. as well?
It looks like it, yeah. We're just finalizing it now for November.
Ooh, there we go. Okay, so follow Dexys on social media apps so you get the lowdown when those dates are available. And again, Kevin, it's an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And thanks for all you've done and for being a voice for many of those out there who can still continue to learn from the music.
Bless you. Thanks, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Man, that is a wonderful album, The Feminine Divine, out July 28th. You can get some tracks on streaming services now. And of course, you got to check out the To Rye remix, To Rye As It Should Have Sounded. Again, you can hear it right now on streaming. Compare it to the old mix. And I think you'll agree that it really does sound quite gorgeous. And don't forget, there's an extended version of this interview available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and enjoy all the extras. That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on social media. Share them on Facebook, put them in Facebook groups, tweet them out on Twitter or Threads or whatever social media things you use. Of course, you could show your record nerd buddies how to get this podcast on a smartphone of theirs. I'm sure they'll appreciate it. And you're always welcome to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So I'm heading back to the lab now. I'm going to do some more interviews and get some more episodes ready. I'll have a new one here shortly. But in the meantime, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.